Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump today expressed strong support for Gina Haspel, his nominee to head the CIA. Her nomination hearings begin on Wednesday. Haspel faces an uphill climb because of her central role in the CIA's torture program during the George W. Bush administration. CNN reported over the weekend that Haspel offered to drop out of consideration for the job, but was convinced to stay in. Next, Lebanese voters went to the polls yesterday to choose a new government for the first time since 2009. Although official tallies won't be known until later this evening, early results indicate a decline in support for the Western-backed Future Movement, led by Prime Minister Saadel Hariri, and gains for Hezbollah and its allies. Then, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then the most vulnerable Republicans in the House of Representatives are talking less and less about the tax cuts they championed late last year, realizing that Americans don't seem to care about the issue. And this is after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, quote, "If we can't sell this to the American people, we ought to go into another line of work," unquote. And finally, banks in Argentina on Friday raised interest rates to a whopping 40%, just 2 days after raising them to 30.25%. A week ago, they were 27.25%. The rises are aimed at supporting the peso, which has lost a quarter of its value over the past year. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the nomination of Gina Haspel to be the new director of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. President Trump today expressed strong support for Gina Haspel, his nominee, to head the CIA. Her nomination hearings begin on Wednesday. Haspel faces an uphill climb because of her central role in the CIA's torture program during the George W. Bush administration. CNN reported over the weekend that Haspel offered to drop out of consideration for the job, but was convinced by the White House to stay in. John Kiriakou, well, I know you're our show host, but you're also our guest because there's no one better suited to tell the story of the Gina Haspel nomination. You, as the person who revealed and exposed and let the American people know the truth about the CIA torture program and who went to prison because of it, you've also been a leading voice in arousing public opinion in this country to say, guess what, Gina Haspel's nomination should not be confirmed. Now she went to the White House to say she's willing to withdraw. What does it say? Is this coming apart?
This tells me that it is coming apart. The Democrats on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence have been demanding for months classified information on Gina Haspel's background and career at the CIA. A letter was sent by Senators Wyden of Oregon and Heinrichs of New Mexico and Feinstein of California to the CIA about a week ago, saying that this is our fifth letter to you. You have ignored all of our previous letters. We are not going to support this nominee unless you give us this background. Well, they haven't given the Senate committee this background. And I think the easy answer to why is that Gina Haspel has a lot to hide. I know Gina Haspel personally. I worked for her. She was my second level boss when I was working in the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. She's an excellent officer. You know, she was good at recruiting spies to steal secrets. That was her job. She's a perfectly nice person, but that's not at all what the issue is. The issue is the message that this nomination sends to the CIA, to the American people, and to our allies overseas. And really the message in a nutshell is you can commit serious crimes. You can commit crimes against humanity or war crimes, and you can still get promoted. And indeed, you can get promoted to be the director of the CIA. Well, the message that this sends also to our allies overseas is when we talk to you and demarche you on human rights, we're not really serious about it. We really don't care about human rights. We want people to think that we do, but when push comes to shove, we don't. We only care about national security and we'll do anything to ensure our national security, whether it's legal or not, moral, ethical or not. That's all that matters.
John, you wrote the op-ed in the Washington Post several weeks ago. And again, this was right after it appeared March 16th, if people want to find it. The title of John's op-ed is, "I Went to Prison for Disclosing the CIA's Torture. Gina Haspel helped cover it up." John, this article, I have to say, seemed to be a catalyst for a lot of opposition. Of course, you have people like Witness Against Torture, progressive grassroots organizations that are against the CIA's torture program and have been defending you and when you were prosecuted and went to prison during the Obama years for exposing Bush's torture program. There's progressive left-wing people. There's also people within the military and intelligence establishment or retired who also say this is a bad idea. Donald Trump, during the 2016 election campaign, said torture was good. Waterboarding works. He also said we should kill the families of terrorists. I mean, like sort of taking the gloves off, as he now calls it, once he became president. And yet the opposition to Haspel is a wide front right now.
It is. It is a wide front. And it's not just John Kiriakou that, you know, I wrote this op-ed in the Washington Post. It really was a catalyst. What we have seen subsequently is an open letter to the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee signed by 109 retired generals and admirals, including one retired chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, imploring these senators not to make Gina Haspel the CIA director. We're seeing actions today, open letters to the committee by Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, a group of retired CIA, FBI, NSA officers. We're seeing similar letters from the National Religious Coalition Against Torture, from people all across America who have a vested interest in making sure that a torturer is not rewarded for the crimes that she committed.
Why did Gina Haspel show up at the White House Friday?
Yeah, Gina Haspel went to the White House on Friday in order to withdraw her nomination as CIA director. I think Gina Haspel sees the writing on the wall. She probably doesn't have the votes to get this job, but this has become a point of pride for Donald Trump. And we saw both Trump and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House spokeswoman, doubling down on Twitter yesterday and today.
Yeah, Trump said, "My highly respected nominee for CIA director, Gina Haspel, has come under fire because she was too tough on terrorists." Think of that. I mean, this is such nonsense.
Yeah, let's think of that, because that is so preposterous. It reminds me very much of a period in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running against George H.W. Bush, and George Bush was desperate because he was behind in the polls. And at a campaign rally, he said, "The Democrats just want to tear this country down." And Barbara Bush, who was standing next to him, said loudly enough for the microphone to pick up, "Oh, George, no, they don't." Well, that's the same situation here. For Donald Trump to say something so preposterous as that the Democrats oppose Gina Haspel because she's too tough on terrorism, as in the Democrats like terrorism, well, that's just not convincing to anybody.
The other thing that Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, and this is, again, in her, you know, you can see it in different media outlets, is that the reason Gina Haspel is being attacked is because she's a woman.
Right.
That this is a manifestation of male chauvinism and patriarchy. It reminded me a little bit of Madeleine Albright, who criticized women who weren't, you know, anti-war women who were concerned about Hillary Clinton's nomination because they thought Hillary Clinton would take the United States to another war because she loves all wars. And Madeleine Albright said there's a special place in hell for those women who support Hillary Clinton.
Like, I remember
you're
that.
Obligated based on the fact that Hillary Clinton, or in this case, Gina Haspel, is a woman. This is taking the very important issue of women's rights and women's representation and trivializing it and making it devoid of any real progressive social content, as if having Margaret Thatcher as the Prime Minister of the UK was a great boon to, say, working class women or
right.
women in general. Again, it seems to me like sort of desperation.
Oh, I think so. Listen, I think it's wonderful that Donald Trump wants to name a woman as the CIA director. The CIA has been run by white men for the last 70 years, so that's great. But not this woman. If Donald Trump wants, I can introduce him to 50 women who would be qualified, excellent leaders of the CIA, and not one of them would be named Gina Haspel.
Real quick, John, you were in Pakistan. You were part of the team that arrested Abu Zubaydah. He was cooperating, talking to the FBI
yes.
through an Arab-American translator. And then suddenly, and partly, and maybe you can explain to us, Gina Haspel and that team, they authorized or began conducting the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah. After he was cooperating, they waterboarded him 83 times.
83 times.
Simulating drowning.
That's right.
Why did they do it?
They did it because they really, well, there are two reasons. One, and this was the official reason, they really believed that there was another attack coming and that Abu Zubaydah had the information on the attack and they wanted to get it. They realized very quickly that he did not have such information. But because they had already initiated this program, they had to carry it out just to prove to the FBI that they were right and the FBI was wrong. So even though they knew that this torture program was wrong and did not result in the discovery of any actionable intelligence that saved any American lives or disrupted any attacks, they just continue with it. And we only know that now thanks to the Senate torture report. We know how morally bankrupt that entire program was.
What else did they do to Abu Zubaydah?
Oh, a lot of things. Sleep deprivation was very serious. They put him in a dog cage for something like 3 weeks, one of those large dog cages that you see on airplanes. They knew he had an irrational fear of insects, and so they put him in a coffin, and they dumped insects into the coffin with him just to make him crazy. They stripped him naked, and they chained him to an eye bolt in the ceiling so that he couldn't sit or lie down or get comfortable in any way, and they left him there for days, and I mean something like 7, 8, 9 days, just to make him crazy. His heart stopped beating during one waterboarding session. He had to be revived. He had seizures and convulsions. He was foaming at the mouth.
Let me just ask you, John, because we're really out of time. You know, it reminds me of Abu Ghraib, too. All those vivid photos and many of the photos that we didn't see. The culture of torture, where the guards and the torturers kind of get into it, and it becomes its own thing. In other words, its own institution. And the level of debauchery and sort of not, you know, you become something other than human where you have no empathy capacity and you just commit these kind of cruelties and barbarisms against other humans, even though at that point, certainly there's no actionable intelligence.
No actionable intelligence. You know, we talked about the banality of evil after the Second World War, and that's what this is. This is the banality of evil. This evil becomes commonplace where you don't even really think about it anymore. You don't even think about how evil it is, and you don't question yourself and ask, is this really who I want to be? Is this the country that I want us to be? The answer, I think, is a resounding no, and we need to show that by opposing Gina Haspel.
That's the voice of John Kiriakou. John is the co-host of this show, Loud and Clear. We're talking about the Gina Haspel nomination. I want to encourage people to go and read John Kiriakou's op-ed from March in the Washington Post. It's titled, I Went to Prison for Disclosing the CIA's Torture. Gina Haspel helped cover it up. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Lebanese voters went to the polls yesterday to choose a new government for the first time since 2009. Although official tallies won't be known until later this evening, early results indicate a decline in support for the Western-backed Future Movement led by Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri and gains for Hezbollah and its allies. We're joined from Beirut by Jana Nagal. She is an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. Welcome, Jana.
Thank you. How are you?
Well, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Tell us, in a nutshell, what exactly does this mean for Lebanon and for the United States?
So we can start from reading the news coming from the Zionist entity, where the Minister of Education this morning said that they don't perceive the Lebanese government as a Lebanese government anymore, but they perceive it as equal to Hezbollah from now on, which might mean that new equations in the region will be set. This is not final yet, because the final results haven't been announced.
You know, and this doesn't change the makeup of the Lebanese parliament in any way. Is that right?
It does change it in a way, in a small manner. But what it changes actually is the strength of the Hariri group, where now it is very unlikely that he will come back again as a prime minister. This is one. Two, you have a much stronger Christian right-wing group, with the Lebanese forces having around 15 candidates in the parliament. So yeah, there's this shift where specifically Beirut, which used to be known that as the citadel of Hariri, is not that anymore. Where Hezbollah has won in Beirut, and where up until now, the results haven't been announced because Hariri is refusing to accept that he was defeated in Beirut.
Jana, this is the first time ever in a Lebanese election that Lebanese in the diaspora outside the country were allowed to vote. Do you think that had any impact on the results?
I don't think it had a large impact, because the percentage of participation was very low. Anyways, the percentage of participation in all of Lebanon was extremely low. In Beirut, it was around 32%. In Lebanon, it was around 47%. One very important thing that I think we should look at is the new kind of opposition that existed in this election all over Lebanon. So for the past 9 years, people were nagging about the situation, about the poverty, about the lack of services, the lack of health coverage, etc. This is the first time, probably, after the civil war, that a real opposition was running in the election, meaning even the Lebanese Communist Party, as independent from all of the political parties that exist in the parliament.
You know, this is an important issue, too, is like just about every other country on the planet. This election was about the economy, at least for the most part. And many, many Sunni Muslims in Lebanon were just sort of tired of Hariri's stagnant economic policies. And they were tired, frankly, of Saudi involvement, I think, in the country. And as Jana pointed out, there are a lot of parties in Lebanon, and I think a lot of Lebanese voters decided it was time to try something new.
Right. This is very true. I think the opposition, I mean, yes, this opposition that has been created since 2015 and that has been accumulating in the streets and in the demonstrations, it has attracted people from all religions, from all sects, including, of course, the Sunnis of Beirut, who have historically been tied post-civil war, they have historically been tied to Hariri. So we are witnessing an opposition which has been able up till now to accumulate, to organize since 2015 in the streets, in demonstrations, and organizing with people in the different regions and across sects and across religions, where in these elections, we haven't won anything, but there is a huge percentage that has been accumulated by this opposition. And it also has resulted in a certain schism, in a certain detachment of specifically the Sunnis of Beirut from Hariri, with which they have been attached since the post-war, since the start of the post-civil war period. So I think, yeah, this election is very indicative of what has been happening in Lebanon at the level of the differences in relationship between the people themselves and their leadership, their traditional leadership.
Jana, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Lebanese foreign policy and whether or not you anticipate any changes. And the reason I ask is a paragraph in today's Washington Post, where it says Hezbollah and its allies appear set to easily take more than 43 seats in the 128-seat parliament, which would enable them to veto any laws that the Shia militant group opposes. Hezbollah itself appears to have added one seat, giving it a total of 13. Hezbollah, of course, is considered a terrorist organization by the United States, although the European Union differentiates between Hezbollah's political and armed wings. Do you think that this stronger showing in the Lebanese parliament by Hezbollah and associated groups would lead to any changes in foreign policy, especially as it relates to Syria or Yemen, for example?
I think the changes in foreign policy have started with the new president, with our new president, Aoun, when he was very clear to announce that this country is a country that is pro-resistance, and that the government, is pro-resistance, and that we are anti-Israel and we're going to fight and free our land. So I think this is when very strong change has happened. I think for now, this makes it much clearer for the upcoming government that the direction towards which the external policy is going to be harsher against Israel, but also easier. I mean, it's going to have less stress on Hezbollah concerning Yemen. I mean, looking at what happened this year with MBS and the kidnapping of Hariri, you can see how important the external, the foreign relationships of Lebanon are, which means that now that these foreign relationships will be more pro-resistance and more anti-Israel, this is going to have stressful, and this might mean MBS will take different steps towards Lebanon.
MBS, of course, is Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and real leader now in Saudi Arabia. We're talking with Jeanna Nakal. She's an independent political researcher, and she's a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. We're speaking to her. Normally, we speak to Jeanna from Beirut. Today, she's speaking to us from Tunis. You know, Jeanna, in our last couple of minutes, just one or two quick questions. In the Western media, especially, I was looking at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal today, and neither should be looked to for any real insight about Lebanese politics or politics in the Middle East. But they're presenting the election as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran playing out in the electoral terrain of Lebanon. International relations are, of course, impacted by and impact on Lebanon. But it seems to me that this kind of reductionism about Lebanese politics completely misses the point. But you're there. You're a Lebanese political commentator and journalist. What's your response to those publications?
First of all, I think it's very imperialist of them to perceive a people's decision upon their who will be their representative as a proxy war for some other bigger forces and powers in the region. I think that the peoples of Lebanon have decided upon who they think that it is their representative specifically because of Hezbollah's position vis-à-vis Israel. Meaning, I just want to also add one very important thing. We have run as the Communist Party against Hezbollah in these elections because we perceive that Hezbollah's project, internal project, is very, or policies are very different from ours. But at the same time, we see that their general policy, meaning resistance, is something that we both agree on. And this is something very important that we need to highlight, specifically that we have a number of quasi-native informants who talk about Hezbollah's role or Hezbollah's anti-working class policies, anti-working class approaches. This is not the case when it comes to foreign affairs. This is the case, definitely, when it comes to the internal structure of Lebanon. But talking about Hezbollah, we need to always remember that this is currently the resistance fighting the white settler colonial imperialist powers that is Israel in the region.
Those are really important points, and I'd like to find a way, John, to have, if John is available, to come back and talk about some of the nuance, the points of unity against imperialism, against colonialism, against the Israeli government's interventionist policies and its policies towards the Palestinians, and also differences in terms of the domestic political and class struggle in Lebanon. That's an important discussion and not discussed at all here, certainly in the United States. We hope you will come back. But right now, John, I think we're out of time.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are out of time. We were joined from Tunis by Jeanne Nakal. She's an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can also check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, welcome back.
Nice to hear your voice.
Brian, today, not today, but this week we celebrate the birthday of a great American, one who is generally overlooked.
Indeed, John Brown. His birthday was May 5th, this past weekend. It's really something, Bill, when we talk about public education, because we're talking on so many different issues, access to education, access to resources, teachers' pay. There's also content. And of course, perhaps most important is content. All around the country, people, meaning when we were all children, learned about Robert E. Lee. There are Robert E. Lee statues all over the country. We didn't learn much about John Brown. In fact, Robert E. Lee was the head of the U.S. military forces that captured John Brown.
Right.
Talk about his birthday and what you did.
Well, we go every May 5th. We go to the Adirondacks, where John Brown is buried with his family, and his farmhouse is maintained by New York State as a state monument. And the interesting thing is, John Brown came to the Adirondacks following black leadership. I mean, blacks by the mid-1800s, blacks were self-liberating, and several of them had started a community that they called Timbuktu in the Lake Placid area, and John Brown came up there to be part of the Underground Railroad and part of the effort of free African slaves to make farming lives for themselves. So he's a real hero, and he's overlooked or obscured or deleted from American history. But at this pivotal moment in our history, when Confederate statues are coming down and that great memorial we talked about last week is going up, it's worthwhile to remember that John Brown cut through the rhetoric and the argument and the compromises and said, we must abolish slavery. And he invaded Harper's Ferry with a small army in order to precipitate that event. And he's remembered in large sections of the country and among African Americans, certainly, as one of the white people who actually threw his life on the line for abolition.
You know, it's easy to take a quick day trip from Washington, D.C. to Harper's Ferry. I've done this with my own children. And at least at Harper's Ferry now, you can get a real sense of what it was that John Brown did, why he did it, and then how he did it. And the National Park Service gives you what I believe to be a real account of his heroism that day in Harper's Ferry. That's not something you get in the state of Virginia, where Robert E. Lee is still considered to be a hero, where we have a major highway named after Jefferson Davis, where dozens of high schools are named after Robert E. Lee and Confederate generals. The monuments are coming down slowly, which is a great thing. We have a lot of names that we're going to need to change. But in the meantime, it's not hard to get over to Harper's Ferry and really get a sense of what it was that John Brown did.
Yeah, I was at Harper's Ferry a month ago, and I picked up a lot of John Brown material to take to the people up in the Adirondacks so that they could have it in their archive. And you're right that there's a better narrative at Harper's Ferry right now than there was when I first visited, which was about 60 years ago. Then John Brown was considered an insane fanatic, you know, a religious zealot who was out of his mind. The reality is, and Russell Banks has written the definitive novel about John Brown called Cloud Splitter, The Cloud Splitter. But Brown was single-minded in his determination to end slavery. And what he was determined to do was to not compromise so that the Confederate States stayed in the Union and slavery was a permanent institution. He was determined to create a crisis that would force slavery to be dealt with once and for all. Now, I think, you know, if he were around today, he'd be right with us on mass incarceration and all the evolutions in the afterlife of slavery. But a great American, without a doubt, and he died at the age of 59, hanged by Robert E. Lee for the crime of demanding that slavery end.
Indeed. When you go to a Harper's Ferry Museum, there's different museums. And as Bill has said, a lot of them are pretty bad or were pretty bad. But there's the African American Museum that was created later at Harper's Ferry. And when you walk in, there's a big quote, and it's from Malcolm X. It's a message to white people who want to be against racism. He said, and of course, Malcolm died in 1965. So he's talking about the early 60s when white people are at last, or at least some part of the white population, standing with the black community in demanding civil rights. And Malcolm's, the quote says to white people, I'm paraphrasing, if you want to support black people, be like John Brown.
Yes. And in fact, if you could trace our history from Students for a Democratic Society and the Weather Underground, we took that quite to heart. John Brown was and is a hero to us. And it's worth noting that Henry David Thoreau wrote a brilliant essay called Captain John Brown, in which he said John Brown set the path for the rest of us to do the right thing. And W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a book about John Brown in which he claimed was his best book. And it was a defense of John Brown at Harper's Ferry.
Yeah. And very important because, again, we're talking about public education. Public education and education in general is not static. The content is informed by the prevailing and dominant narrative in society or the countervailing narrative of the people who are struggling for justice, if that struggle reaches the kind of crescendo that actually forces change. I mean, we learned about the Civil War from the viewpoint of Robert E. Lee until the 1930s when the teachers' union, led by leftists, insisted that we learn the Civil War from the viewpoint of John Brown, from the viewpoint of Abraham Lincoln, from the viewpoint of Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth. These were names in the truth telling of those who brought an end to slavery were basically omitted from the history textbooks and the classroom curriculum, not just in Virginia, but in New York State. That's the reality.
You're absolutely right. And I think what's important, and we could do a lot more of this when you and I are in conversation, is that the content of education is always contested. The content of history is always contested. And that contestation has a lot to do with whether we can imagine a future different from today or whether we're stuck in kind of the sins of our past in a certain sense and unable to move forward. But moving forward requires taking into account the true history of what we've been through. And I think that memorial I visited a week ago is testament to that. And I think visiting the Adirondacks and John Brown is a testament to that.
Yeah. You know, it's important, John, we're running out of time, which we always do in this segment with Bill Ayers. Every Monday, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers. We never know quite where we're going in the discussion because we focus on something. But how people remember history, how our memories are formed, is so critically important to how we interpret everything that's happening around us and about us in the current reality. And that's why I think it's actually critically important that we, at least here at Loud and Clear, with Bill Ayers, focus on the missing part of American history, too forgotten.
That's right.
John Brown. You had a poem. There was a poem there read by Martin Espada or Martin Espada. Bill Ayers, we don't have much time, but it's an important poem.
Well, I would say it's important to note that there's a group called John Brown Lives up in the Adirondacks. They focus mostly on prison work, but they gave the John Brown Lives Award to two outstanding revolutionaries. One is Sophia Elijah, the great attorney and activist, prison activist, and the other was Martine Espada, the revolutionary poet. And he read a poem at John Brown's grave right after putting a wreath on the grave. And if you have time, I'll read it.
Go ahead.
It's called Imagine the Angels of Bread. This is the year that squatters evict landlords, gazing like admirals from the rail of the roof deck, or levitating hands in praise of steam in the shower. This is the year that shawled refugees deport judges who stare at the floor and their swollen feet as files are stamped with their destinations. This is the year that police revolvers stove hot blister the fingers of raging cops and nightsticks splinter in their palms. This is the year that dark-skinned men lynched a century ago returned to sip coffee quietly with the apologizing descendants of their executioners. This is the year that those who swim the border's undertow and shiver in boxcars are greeted with trumpets and drums at the first railroad crossing on the other side. This is the year that the hands pulling tomatoes from the vine uproot the deed to the earth that sprouts the vine. The hands canning tomatoes are named in the will that owns the bedlam of the cannery. This is the year that the eyes stinging from the poison that purifies toilets awaken at last to the sight of a rooster-loud hillside, pilgrimage of immigrant birth. This is the year that cockroaches become extinct, that no doctor finds a roach embedded in the ear of an infant. This is the year that the food stamps of adolescent mothers are auctioned like gold doubloons, and no coin is given to buy machetes for the next bouquet of severed heads in coffee plantation country. If the abolition of slave manacles began as a vision of hands without manacles, then this is the year. If the shutdown of extermination camps began as imagination of a land without barbed wire or the crematorium, then this is the year. If every rebellion begins with the idea that conquerors on horseback are not many-legged gods, then they too drown if plunged in the river, then this is the year. So may every humiliated mouth, teeth like desecrated headstones, fill with the angels of bread.
We're going to leave it with those beautiful and important words. That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joined us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, a radical manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The most vulnerable Republicans in the House of Representatives are talking less and less about the tax cuts they championed late last year, realizing that Americans don't seem to care about the issue. And this is after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, and I quote, "If we can't sell this to the American people, we ought to go into another line of work," unquote. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He's a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM channel 126. Dr. Leon, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So why is it that Americans just don't seem to care about these Republican tax cuts as a campaign issue?
I think primarily because these Trump tax cuts are falling in the same line that former vice president under Ronald Reagan, George Bush, called voodoo economics. The trickle down isn't trickling down to the degree that President Trump or candidate Trump projected that they would. And so people are, it's almost like vaporware. People are saying, well, okay, well, where is it? And the business owners that are talking about having given their employees a $1,000 bonus here or $5,000, those are so few and far between. They're almost one-offs. And people just aren't seeing it.
You know, I'm reminded of a Politico article from last March. They were covering the special election in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district, which was a Republican district. It had gone for Trump by nearly 20 points, and a Democrat won that special election, Connor Lamb. But this article in Politico was entitled "Republicans Abandon Tax Cut Message in Pennsylvania Special Election." And the subtitle is, "It's a sign they think the issue isn't resonating, potentially a big problem in the midterms." It looks like that's coming to pass.
It is coming to pass. If you find money in your pocket, it will resonate. if you find money in an envelope that comes in the mail, that will resonate. The average voter, I don't believe, is seeing the tangible result of this promise. And I know a lot of people were saying, you're going to see a benefit now, but the real determinant isn't going to be until next year's tax filings. So that, too, I think, is playing into whether or not or to what degree the average voter is that they've just filed their 2017 returns in 2018. So they're not going to see any real benefit if they see one until they file next year.
If they see one.
If they see one.
Well, some people are seeing big results from the tax plan. Say, take Sprint, for instance. Now, Sprint, again, posted a net decrease in its earnings and yet made its first profit in 11 years. And this, of course, is on the eve of the T-Mobile-Sprint merger talks and possible acquisition. But, of course, the reason Sprint is posting profits in spite of the fact that its earnings did not increase was because this tax plan is just a big giveaway to corporations. And that's who Trump's real constituencies are, or what he's hoping. He's hoping he's got a certain part of the population that backs him. You know, let's say it's 35% of the population. They're going to be Trump supporters no matter what. But Wall Street and the big sectors of the corporate America were a little bit skeptical about Trump because guess what? They thought Trump only cares about Trump, not about them. The tax plan, I think, is a calling card from Trump to Wall Street and to corporate America saying, look, I'm willing to help redistribute the wealth in this country from poor people and working class people and middle class people directly into your coffers. And I expect you in return to drop your skepticism and now embrace me, Donald Trump.
Well, do you remember the night that he signed the tax cut into law? He flew to Mar-a-Lago for the weekend like he normally does. He had a dinner for a whole bunch of his billionaire friends.
Which we also paid for, by the way.
Which we also paid for. The taxpayers paid for that. And he said at that dinner, which was covered in the press, I made all of you a heck of a lot richer today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what he did.
Absolutely right. And those laborers who did see an increase in their take-home pay because of a change in the tax rate, again, that's nice now. But the real bottom line, the foot and tie on the spreadsheet at the end of the day, we really won't see until people have to file their 2018 returns. And there's also, I think, tangentially to this conversation, there was an article, I think, in yesterday's New York Times that says that an urgent debate for California Republicans how to get back in the game. And what this article is saying
is, I saw that.
It's no secret that the state's Republican Party has been in decline for 20 years. Its challenges have been aggravated by the election of Trump, as he's pushed policies that don't resonate in California. And I think we know that California is a Democratic state, but I think this problem could be a bellwether for what's to come.
Yeah, indeed. And again, you know, as we talked about, George W. Bush did the same thing. A tax plan that's basically a redistribution of wealth, the wealth of society, that which we all depend on for the providing goods and services. He took from the bottom and gave to the top. And at the same time, he gave some parts of the working population a little bit more in a tax break for that year. And people, as you said, if I get $300 more right now, I'm going to think like, hey, that's $300 more. That's not nothing. That maybe impacts my consciousness. On the other hand, that will be very short-lived. And the other part of what the Republicans are doing is that they're deliberately bankrupting the national budget so they can then carry out devastating, catastrophic
social
reductions
cuts
in social services that the same taxpayers are dependent on. So it's a game, and it's a trick.
And we see that playing itself out right now with teachers in Oklahoma, with teachers in Texas. The states can't afford books. The states can't afford teachers, and we can go all the way back to Ronald Reagan in the 1980s when he started cutting taxes, and the money that the national government was providing to the states through grants, through other types of programs, matching fund type programs and other types of programs that the national government was working with the states on, that money is long gone. And we're now seeing that the states are suffering through this redistribution of wealth trick.
Let's stay with the Reagan analogy, because also the other thing that Reagan did, and he's touted this not only for national security to make America great again in the 1980s, but also as a job creator, was to almost double military spending.
That's right.
Again, even though there was no country marching on the United States. And here you have Trump also at the same time cutting social programs, food stamps, the things that human beings actually need, again, making healthcare less and less affordable. There's this huge gargantuan redirection of the national treasury for military, even though the U.S. already spends more than the next 10 countries combined.
And not only that, but I think, John, you could speak to this better than I, the nature of warfare is changing. We're going to asymmetrical warfare. We're no longer really that fearful of the national actor launching missiles, sending the Green Army to fight the Blue Army. It's non-state actors that I believe are posing the greater threat than China will, than Russia will.
And we're 20 years into that now, and we still haven't figured out how to fight that kind of war. To Brian's point, what we're still doing is spending billions upon billions of dollars for the tools that we would need to go head to head against another country on a battlefield. Gone are the days where a war ends because the two sides sit across from each other at a negotiating table and sign some sort of an agreement.
We just ended they're just now talking about ending the Korean War.
Right.
Because that was still
Which has never been ended.
Exactly.
Well, it only started 68 years ago. Let's not jump the gun with a peace treaty. Dr. Leon, there's another piece to this, which is that the Republicans, as they go forward, you know, a lot of them are dropping out of congressional races. They're not just not talking about the Republican tax plan. They're dropping out. In terms of how you think things are going, in terms of how this will play in the population, even though the tax cuts might not offer a lot of relief for working class people, unemployment is very low right now. Officially 3.9%. Trump is actually and obviously crowing about that, taking credit for it. That's also a big factor here, though. I mean, even if you're not making much, if you're working, it makes a difference.
It does make a difference. It is a factor. And unfortunately, the Democrats can't seem to figure out how to put together a message to explain the reality to the populace, that being this is a cycle. This is not a result of Donald Trump. Also, the disparity between unemployment of Latinos and African Americans is still the historic double whatever the national rate is. So you still, even though you've got, we'll just say 3.5% unemployment nationally, you've got close to 7 or 8% amongst African Americans and Latinos. And why they can't find a message is beyond me.
And you know what? At the risk of getting a little bit too technical, it's actually even higher than that.
Oh, absolutely.
Because Ronald Reagan in 1983 decided to count the military as people employed. And so that unemployment rate has been artificially low since 1983.
And we're going to leave, John, because we're out of time. But last fact, according to Forbes last week, 1/3 of all Americans cannot afford to pay health care bills, food, and rent.
And under Trump, it's gotten worse.
That's right.
And under Trump, it's gotten worse.
Because of his cut to Obamacare.
And this is the richest country of the world.
I hate to say we're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined in the studio by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM channel 126. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Banks in Argentina on Friday raised interest rates to a whopping 40%, just 2 days after raising them to 30.25%. A week ago, they were 27.25%. The rises are aimed at supporting the peso, which has lost a quarter of its value over the past year. We're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Steve, Argentina has a long history of economic instability, but it seemed that after the crash of 2002, 2003, they had gotten their economic act together. What happened down there?
Well, Argentina just seems to be the global tragedy case of a country which, you know, should have done well and it continues doing badly. When they had the crisis back in 2008, they had a huge boom, a credit boom. At one stage, having credit being 35% of GDP, and it fell to minus 20% with the crisis. Huge shock to the economy, and it then went into a progressive or left wing administration that was focused upon trying to use tariffs and very domestically oriented policies to try to boost the economy. That had all sorts of issues with it, the usual levels of corruption in various ways, plus some successful policies, some other failure ones. Now it's gone for a totally free market approach, or relatively free market approach. That also isn't working. And because it has to borrow in the United States dollar, nobody will trust Argentina with its own currency, given the rates of devaluation it faces. And they're incredibly susceptible to a fall in the value of the peso, which drives up their import costs, and they're not running a critical current account deficit, but they're running a sort of chronic one, and they never seem to be able to industrialize as well as they should be, given their overall capabilities.
And explain to us, not just to our listeners, but to me, because I think I don't fully understand these issues too. I've seen a couple of articles saying that this rise in interest rates is going to attract foreign investment. But if foreign companies can't borrow in Argentina, they would have to borrow outside. How does this help the Argentine economy?
Well, the main thing it's doing is giving such a boost to the return you get on buying Argentine bonds that people think it's worth the risk of the default. So it isn't so much investing in the industry, it's buying the bonds that then gives them the American dollars. That means they can do the importing they need to do because the manufacturing sector has never quite cut the mustard. So it's not so much investment coming in, but it's purchases of those government bonds, which it has to borrow on the international markets in the American dollar, again, because it has an untrusted currency.
Along those same lines, too, back in 2002, the Argentines sold highly illiquid bonds at whopping rates. And many billions of dollars of those bonds were purchased by a hedge fund here in the United States called Elliott Associates. Now, Elliott famously went after the Argentines a decade later when the Argentines defaulted on the bonds, or at least were threatening to default on the bonds, and sued them in U.S. court. And the suit dragged on for years. Finally, Elliott got its money, but at the cost of growth in the Argentine economy. Are we looking at a replay of this kind of thing?
And also talk about the role of the IMF in that 1998 to 2002 crisis, because, again, there was a global economic crisis in 1998. Argentina was one part of it. It also hit Asia. It hit Russia. Anyway, talk about that as well, if you would.
Well, mainly those IMF always imposes austerity and the belief that you've got to readjust the internal prices so they become competitive internationally, and always regards government spending as wasteful activity. And when one of the things that the IMF has been very slow in learning is that GDP is expenditure. If you spend less, your GDP is going to fall. And when you have a huge cut like the IMF tends to impose, the economy implodes. And this is one reason why Southeast Asian countries like Indonesia will no longer accept the IMF back. They're saying your medicine has been, like, you know, rather than castor oil, it's been closer to cyanide every time we've taken it. But the Southeast Asian countries seem to be able to reorganize themselves and seem to be able to pull in foreign investment in local manufacturing for re-export to the global economy. And that just doesn't seem to be possible in Argentina, even though it's now gone for a large number of industrial parks to try to boost its industrial sector. But it continues going backwards. If you look at its the complexity of its industrial base is measured by Harvard's Atlas of Economic Complexity. It's gone from about 50th in the world to 83rd in the world, and it's had a severe plunge in the last two or three years while this so-called reforming government's been in control. So the reforms, rather than improving the complexity of Argentine industry, which is what it needs to do, have pushed it further backwards. Again, probably because, you know, a large part of the impact of it has been to cut back demand, and you don't produce unless you expect to get that local demand.
And there's a political side to this too, which I want to talk about briefly. After the 1998 to 2002 economic crisis, there was a progressive government, the Kirchner government, the first Kirchner government came in. A lot of Argentina's denationalized industry, again, under pressure from international banks and under pressure from the IMF, Kirchner renationalized those banks and tried to also impose price controls to get control of inflation, did more social spending for working class people. And then with the support of Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution, Kirchner actually decided to try to get out of the debt trap by paying in one fell swoop, and partly financed by Venezuela's oil revenues, all of Argentina's bonds for the United States. In other words, a big sort of trying to pay down debt. And then the government has been, and he died and his wife replaced him. That government was targeted by the U.S. because the U.S. wants to have the kind of government that we've had recently in Argentina, which is a neoliberal government. So there's this intertangling for developing countries, even countries who are rich in resources and would seem to have all of the right indices for economic growth. They can't completely escape, one, the debt trap, or their international connections and really submission to international finance. Anyway, what's your take on that?
Well, an intriguing discussion some years ago with the Argentine embassy. I won't mention the country that I had the discussions in, but this was when Argentina was having one of its many crises, and we're talking about the level of debt that they had, the global debt Argentina was carrying. And the officials I was talking to said, quite frankly, the level of overseas bonds, overseas wealth, overseas bank accounts owned by Argentine's wealthy class is probably equivalent to the national debt. In other words, it's a class conflict that occurs in Argentina, which has never been resolved. It's a major part of why they just don't seem to get out of this trap in the first place.
Well, you know, the country is so rich. It's rich in resources. It has gold and silver and arable land and access to the sea and a highly educated workforce. Are all these economic problems political in nature?
Or class?
Or classist in nature, yeah.
And again, one other peculiarity about Latin America or South America in general is that if you divide consumption into workers' consumption and capitalist consumption in most countries like America, like even the UK and so on, you'll get about a 70-30 ratio. So 70% of the expenditure is by working class, middle class people, 30% by the wealthy. In Argentina and most of Latin America, it's 65% of the wealthy and 35% of the poor. And what you've really got in some ways is the ruling class of South America is trying to keep up with the Joneses, where those Joneses are in Joneses in America. There are contemporaries there rather than domestically. And you get a much more consumption-focused ruling class rather than one focused upon investment. Now, that's a very big difference of the behavior you find in Southeast Asia, where people like Lee Kuan Yew, of course, live a relatively austere lifestyle personally, because anybody who has the power and wealth that he has, and their money goes into industrializing, developing the economy. That just doesn't seem to get through in Argentina with this huge class divide.
The indiscreet decadence of the Argentinian bourgeoisie, perhaps, a problem that's it's never quite put that way, but maybe that's what Steve is talking about. Right, Steve?
I think that's pretty much fundamental, yeah. If you don't have that level of inequality, then you're not going to get the mass consumption market, which is going to encourage you to industrialize and develop your own product base. And that seems to be the trap they're caught in almost all the time.
So here they're taking this drastic step of raising interest rates to 40%. Do you see this as a way out? Is this the first step to Argentina rebuilding its economy and rebuilding it in a permanent way?
Oh, I never see that happening with Argentina, I'm afraid. It seems to be a continual case of left or right, the policies go wrong.
That's right. Well, we were joined by Steve Keen from London. He's the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time today. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Now you can also follow us on Twitter at LoudClearRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.